for the week of October 16th, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 340, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How you doing, Michael?
I hate pronouncing my last name.
Okay.
It's so hard to say. It really is. It's so annoying. It should have been Gannon. Michael Gannon. There's a name you can say.
Okay, I don't know where
Michael
this is
Gannon, Private Eye.
You know, we talk before the show starts, but and then when we start recording, it just goes in all sorts of different places.
Eventually going to focus on entertainment, and what will we discuss this week?
Well, on this week's show, we're going to sing all our comments in the style of Bob Dylan. Or should I say, sing all our comments in the style of Bob Dylan. No? No, okay.
No.
Actually, we won't, but we still will be discussing how people reacted to the news of Dylan winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. Sal Nunziato, artist and blogger at Burnwood Tonight, will join us to ponder whether Dylan's work is, in fact, literature. He'll also go one-on-one with Michael, debating the latest batch of nominees, forget this, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, of which I believe Bob Dylan is the president, correct? If I'm not mistaken?
Not the president, but he's certainly in there.
Okay. During our book filter segment, Michael will clue us into the launch of a new mystery series by Joe Eday called Simply IQ. We'll also hear about the announcement of upcoming books from a rock star and a rock star of business, Bob Iger. On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss Amazon's serious step forward into the world of music streaming and why every song request now begins with the word Alexa. And I'm just waiting for all of the Alexas to catch up with the fact that nothing else.
Or Billy Joel's daughter to call up and say, why? What do you want?
Right. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll debate the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We depend heavily on ComScore. You'll find a link to them in our show notes. Though they missed one of the biggest box office hits of the year in Japan.
I was wondering if you were going to catch that, and I'm glad you did.
We're not quite sure why, but hopefully we can send an email to them and say, hey, what happened to this one? But we don't just depend on ComScore. We also look at Hollywood Reporter and Variety, which is how we spotted this movie that we haven't been tracking the last few weeks. Box office profit, box office mojo, the numbers, you name it. And looking at all that info, the number one movie around the world is Tom Hanks in Inferno. $50 million over the weekend. It opened in 53 territories. Pretty solid international start for the latest film from Ron Howard and Tom Hanks. Based on a novel by Dan Brown. It's a series of movies, The Da Vinci Code, whatever the second one's called, and now this one. So a good year for Tom Hanks. After having one of his lowest grossing movies of all time, he has now had Sully, an Oscar hopeful, they say, and Inferno, which is a popcorn flick. So Tom Hanks remains one of the biggest stars in the world.
Angels and Demons.
Angels and Demons. Thank you very much. That book actually is better than Da Vinci Code, but boy, that's a splitting hairs sort of different. None of them are good. At number two is another comeback film of sorts. It's Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, directed by Tim Burton. $32 million over the weekend. So that's at $200 million worldwide. And so it looks like this movie will get to triple its budget and therefore look like a solid hit for Tim Burton, who hasn't had a lot going on recently, either critically or commercially.
Well, which means, will they do the sequels? Because this is a book series.
Well, we'll have to see. Certainly, if it makes enough money, they will.
Yeah, good point.
At number three around the world is Ben Affleck in The Accountant, which sounds goofy, but is in fact about an autistic man or man on the autistic spectrum who also has certain skills, as they say. It grossed $27 million over the weekend, and the people I know who saw it kind of thought it was a good, fun, weird little B-movie.
Yes, I've heard the same thing.
Yeah, so that's sort of interesting. Makes me sort of want to check it out. And number four is a Chinese Hong Kong crime drama called Operation Mekong, which is really doing big business. $21 million over the weekend, $140 million worldwide. At number five, doing not so much business, is Girl on the Train. $19 million over the weekend, $75 million worldwide. But nobody liked it. And box office is falling pretty hard. It needs to make about $160 million worldwide in order to be... it needs to make about $130 million, I think, to be considered a solid launch to this movie and as a success story. I'm not sure if they'll get there, but it's only playing in 21 territories. We have to see where it ends up.
I think it will actually wind up getting to $130 million. Maybe not just in domestically in the U.S., but...
No. We know that's not what we care about at all.
Right. I do think DreamWorks owns this for the entire world. So I'm pretty sure you get to 130, you'll be fine.
Okay. And number six is Storks, an animated movie. $16 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide. Also sort of a question mark as to whether that's going to be considered a success. Right behind it, one movie that is not a success is The BFG, Spielberg's new movie. That opened in China, I believe. That's why it made $13 million over the weekend. It's at $144 million worldwide, which is just about what the movie cost to make.
And you're right, it did open in China.
Yes. And number eight is Luck Key. This is a Korean comedy. It's a remake of a Japanese comedy called Key of Life about an out-of-work actor who swaps lives with an assassin, and they both end up being better off for it. He makes $12 million over the weekend, and it just opened on a Wednesday, I guess, because it's at $13 million worldwide.
You said he makes $12 million?
He, Mr. Luck Key. Yes, oh, okay. I don't know why I said he. But he, Kevin Hart, has had another big hit film. It's Kevin Hart, What Now? It's a concert film, mostly, though it begins with an action sequence for some reason, but it's mostly him on stage doing comedy, and it made $12 million on its opening weekend. Some people would say, well, that's not as much as his last concert film, but that's a tremendous amount of money for a documentary film to make, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for that, I mean, it's on 2,567 screens, or at least the number of sites. It's around $4,600 per screen. Yeah, that's a pretty good run for a concert film.
They say it costs $10 million to make.
Yeah, okay, maybe.
But I mean, is that $10 million all his salary? I mean,
well, no, I'm sure.
Because it's Kevin Hart. Surely he's going to have a play in the box office for a movie like this.
I would agree.
Well, at number 10 is a hit. It's Bridget Jones's Baby. You've seen the movie. Now you can get the book, which has just hit stores. It grossed $10 million over the weekend. It's at $165 million worldwide. I don't recommend either.
Wait a second. Is the movie based on the book, or is the book based on the movie?
I think they sort of were developed concurrently.
Okay. Just checking.
But I can't swear that. But given the timing of the book's release, I believe it was out in the UK a little bit earlier, but it's just hit North America. But I believe sort of... the project sort of came together at the same time, but don't hold me to that. I'm not sure.
Okay.
At number 11 is Deepwater Horizon. Mark Wahlberg and Peter Berg teaming up to tell a disaster story with a somewhat hopeful ending. $10 million over the weekend, $75 million worldwide. At number 12 is The Magnificent Seven. Denzel Washington is proving his draw overseas. The movie's made $8 million this weekend. It's at $150 million worldwide, with overseas just about to match what it made domestically. And number 13 is I Belonged to You. This is a Chinese romantic comedy about two radio DJs in love. Another $7 million over the weekend, $110 million worldwide. So a big hit romantic comedy for China. And number 14 is Finding Dory, which of course passed the $1 billion mark and continues to pull in a few extra bucks. And number 15, another animated hit, The Secret Life of Pets, which is now at $860 million worldwide. And now a third animated film in a row. It's not on ComScore's list. We found it because I think it was The Hollywood Reporter had a story about how well this movie was.
I think it was
doing.
Variety, actually. Variety had a story, basically.
Yeah, about the Japanese box office. Sometimes you will now see individual stories about Korea's box office weekend, China's box office weekend, and in this case, Japan's box office weekend, because those are big markets. The movie is called Your Name. It's a Japanese animated film about teenagers who are switching bodies in their dreams. There's this boy in the city who suddenly finds in his dreams, he thinks he's a girl living in the country. And he's like, what the heck is going on with that? It made $4.5 million over the weekend, and it's made $150 million in Japan. It's a huge, huge box office success story. It was directed by Makoto Shinkai, who directed it, edited it, wrote a novel with the same idea that's just come out in Japan as well. He also shot it, though I don't know. He's credited as the cinematographer, though I don't know how that works in an animated film, what that entails. It's an interesting question. But it's all Makoto Shinkai, It's his baby, and it's a big, big hit. The question is, why wasn't it on ComScore's list? Was it released by a distributor they don't do business with?
Or ComScore doesn't collect box office in Japan.
For Japan? Yeah. They must.
Well, you never know.
It's one of the biggest markets in the world. We got to send them an email to find out. But hey, if you're in a country and you can see you've got this number one movie in your country and it made enough money that it should be on our charts and we're not discussing it, something's wrong. Let us know. How can they do that?
Well, they can email us. They listen to us. Our listeners can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like our page on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. Our page should come up. And very often we'll get stories from listeners on our Facebook page, and we'll include them in the next week's roundup.
That's right. And some of the movies coming up that we're looking forward to include Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. That played at the New York Film Festival. And it's a movie done in that can be seen in multiple formats, including 4K in 3D at 120 frames per second. That's the ideal way that Ang Lee wants you to see this movie. But it's only going to be playing in two theaters in the entire country in that format, in that particular format.
Well, for right now. I mean, right now it's at two. I think it'll probably get up to four, but yeah.
There'll be more worldwide, but the article said just two in America.
Yeah. Carolyn Giardina.
They don't even have the LA theater picked out yet.
Yeah, it's probably going to be the Arclight Hollywood.
All right. Well, it's playing at Lincoln Square in New York, the Arclight in Hollywood. And the story, you know, the movie's been reviewed and there have been feature stories about it, Ang Lee pushing technological barriers. But you know something's not great when the director's saying, give it a chance. Not, oh my God, you're going to be wowed. You won't believe what you're seeing, but give it a chance.
Well, over at Celluloid Junkie, we've had numerous articles on this and numerous posts by Patrick Von Sikowski, who has seen the test footage and the trial. Well, it's not test footage. It was footage from this film.
He didn't see the whole film.
He did not see the whole film. You know, at NAB this year, Ang Lee showed up and you know, presented clips. The same thing at IBC in Amsterdam. And, you know, people really liked it. They really felt it was different enough. But the problem is, it's one thing to see clips and to have those clips look amazing. It's another thing
to have 2 hours.
2 hours, and you actually need a story, and maybe it doesn't necessarily need that technology the whole way through. I don't know. I haven't seen the film.
Well, it's more 2 hours of a visual look is a lot different than, 4 minutes.
Correct.
It's not just the story. It's just maybe that look wears thin. And of course, you have to wear glasses.
Well, yes. Part of the issue that I'm hearing from people who have seen it is that for 2 hours, you're looking at this and it's so vivid. It's so crystal clear. It's hyper real. So much so that, I mean, think about it. Twice the resolution. It's in 3D. And 120 frames per second, that is shooting very, very fast. So everything is crystal clear. And so there's no makeup. All the artifice is removed. So even the acting, if there's a false note in the acting, you really see it. And apparently, even the extras in the background, you can tell, well, they're not talking. They're like faking it. They're like looking at, some coach off screen, telling them like when to move around.
Right, but that's a question of a learning curve as far as to get better. The question we have, is it worth the effort? Is it something that you're excited by to see more of? I have friends who saw the entire film in this format, in this way. And they were like, it looks like crappy video. It looks like crappy video that you shot in the 70s. It has a certain hyper-present nature to it, but it's exhausting, it's annoying wearing the glasses, and they didn't like it. They thought it looked crappy. They thought it looked like a telenovela.
Which is the problem with, like, say, The Hobbit. That was the issue there.
Yes, yes, yes. And The Hobbit, of course, again, they realized they need to make sets more realistic, use different materials. You can't get away with certain shortcuts. You have to learn how to shoot in sound versus no sound, color versus black and white. The question is whether all of this 4K, 3D, 120 frames per second, whether that extra high frame rate is worth the bother. I don't think we know the answer yet.
I don't think so either. I think, somebody will make a movie where it works and then everybody will want to do it and they will do it poorly, just like 3D.
Well, no, somebody made a movie in color and it works, and now most movies are in color. It doesn't have to be that way. Either it's worth it for all movies, or it's only worth it once in a blue moon, or it's not worth it at all. We'll find out.
So you're like, yes, no, and maybe.
Well, I'm just saying, it's not like, oh, if somebody does it well, other people will try and it will suck. Not necessarily. It's just 3D is not necessary for most movies. It's a pointless artistic, you know, waste of time. It can be done really well. It can be done artistically. It can be really fun and satisfying and improve the commercial chances for a movie. But a Woody Allen comedy will not be shot in 3D. It shouldn't be shot at all, of course, but that's a different story.
Oh, my goodness. Low blow to Woody Allen. What did he ever do to you?
You know what I mean. You know, we'll have to see, but it means learning how to do things differently, right?
Yes, it does. Now, speaking of doing things differently, that's exactly what the Nobel Committee, who select the Nobel Prize each year for literature, did just last week. In fact, joining us to talk about whether this is good or bad for rock and roll, and this is what we're going to talk about, is Sal Nunziato. He's a regular guest on the show when we cover music. Sal was the co-owner of the late lamented record store NYCD, which I guess you could say about every record store these days, although maybe not a lot of them.
I don't really miss coconuts.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe none of them are lamented. You know, they're kind of glad that they closed down. But in any case, you can go to his blog, Burnwood Tonight, and see a video of the band Posies performing in that store way back when. You can also visit the blog for regular mixtapes, musings about music, showdowns between classic albums with fans voting on their favorites, or find Sal at record shows around the tri-state area in New York City when he's not performing on stage as a drummer. Sal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So here's a question. Does Dylan have the worst voice in rock and roll history, or just the second worst?
Neither. I was never one of those people that thought Dylan did not have a good singing voice. I think when Dylan sings a song in his style, it's as emotive and heartfelt and passionate as some of our great vocalists. So unlike, say, Lou Reed, another person who's often, you know, referred to as someone who couldn't sing, Lou Reed really talks more than he sings. And when he does sing, just sings in one style. It's always been the same. But with Dylan, from album to album, he changes his voice. There's the Nashville Skyline voice, which is my least favorite, but there's the Blonde on Blonde voice, there's the early folk voice, and there's the Blood on the Tracks voice, and I think he does a wonderful job.
Yeah, the question was written for me, I have to say. I frankly like his voice.
Well, he's obviously one of the most important singers of all time. He's hugely influential as far as opening the doors. His singing in rock and roll is akin to Marlon Brando as an actor. You know, he just opened the door to a whole new way of acting, and Dylan did the same way with singing. I brought it up because it's just funny that people still debate or go, oh, God, his voice is so bad. You would think that was done with. And it's the same idea about the debate over, is rock and roll poetry? Which it is not. It's a different art form. You had Steve Allen way back when making fun of rock and roll on late night television because he would read out the lyrics to rock songs and go, you ain't nothing but a hound dog. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. You know, everybody would laugh and go, ho, ho, rock and roll is so stupid. But of course, it's not. It's a different art form, right?
Yes, I always hated Steve Allen for doing that. I thought it was a very cheap shot. Because out of context, of course, it's going to sound silly. If you put it in terms of, well, you're not going to win an Oscar for your record. Yeah, maybe this whole thing seems a little strange. But if there's any one person that can break this little mold and rule, I would have to say Bob Dylan, and I'm fine with it. I mean, it's not my call. I'm certainly not sitting here and going, damn it, I can't believe they gave it to Bob Dylan instead of, you know,
Philip Roth.
I think Bob Dylan is there's no one like him. There will never be anyone like him. And he's got thousands upon thousands of words and you know, there are those who would argue that the songs on some of his records aren't really songs, that they are more literature or poetry than music. I mean, it's not my call. It's so I can't really say whether, you know, it's the right thing or the wrong thing. I'm just, I'm happy for him and I'm happy for it. And you know, I can't really argue against it.
Well, Billy Collins, who is a former U.S. poet laureate, wrote, and he is quoted in the New York Times as saying, most song lyrics don't really hold up without the music, and they aren't supposed to. Thus, Steve Allen. You know, we just kind of covered that. And he goes on to say, Bob Dylan is in the 2% club of songwriters whose lyrics are interesting on the page, even without the harmonica and the guitar, and his very distinctive voice. I think he does qualify as poetry.
I agree. But also, there are certain words. You know, I was talking about this the other day, where people, you know, once the announcement was made and people were posting all over social media and they were each pulling their own favorite lyrics and quotes and songs and what's your favorite Dylan song, and somebody posted this, and I don't have it in front of me, and so I can't really do more than just relate the story. But somebody posted these fantastic lyrics, and my initial thought was, wow, what song is that? Is that from Blonde on Blonde? Is that from Blood on the Tracks? And it ended up being from Tweedledee and Tweedledum from Love and Theft. And I think that we also just take Dylan for granted. I mean, I make fun of Wiggle Wiggle. You know, Wiggle Wiggle from Under the Red Sky, you know, is probably the song I always go to. I even went to it when the announcement was made about the Nobel Prize. You know, but what about Wiggle Wiggle? He wrote that. He shouldn't win a Nobel Prize. Of course, I was kidding. But there's so much, even within the songs that you would put at the bottom of the list for good Dylan songs, the man knows how to write. And so, you know, he's got to be the exception. There's got to be one, and it's got to be Bob Dylan.
I don't know if it needs to be the exception. I think that just as the Nobel Prize for Literature has gone to novelists, and then poets, and then playwrights, and last year a journalist who compiles oral histories and crafts them into nonfiction books, I think a body of work by songwriters as songs, not just as lyrics pulled off a page, but as songs, deserves to be in that pantheon as well. I think it's not a mistake. It's not like Michelin guide giving Dylan 3 stars, even though he doesn't have a restaurant. I think it is literature, and I think he belongs there, and I think others may be in that mix down the road. It could be somebody, you know, from other parts of the world, like, Cayetano Veloso, or some artist who has helped launch movements of music in other parts of the world, not just rock and roll in America, but I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So how did you react? Or you know, nowadays people find out, do you feel obliged to go on social media? Everybody wants to know what you think. How do you get the word out about what you think? What did you do when people said, what album should I listen to? Or what do I do next?
Well, I think something tells me I've spoken to you about this before on the last podcast, but I don't necessarily go after top news stories to write about or to post on social media. I feel like so many people are doing it, and there are so, you know, what can I add except, yes, I'm for it, I'm not for it. If something comes up where I think the discussion is worthy, I'll weigh in. But for this particular event, I heard the news. And actually, my first thought was, wow, that's pretty great. I thought Bono from U2 was the first rock star to win the Nobel Prize. I don't know why I thought it. Maybe it's just
a Nobel Prize, not obviously the one for literature.
No. Just, you're right. Just a Nobel Prize. And I don't know why I thought that or where it came from. It could be the endless videos of him hugging everyone. I have no idea. It's just, my reaction wasn't like anything more than that's great. That's really what it was. I wasn't compelled to write about it or to post anything about it. All I did was somebody asked me what my favorite Bob Dylan song was, and I answered him. And that was really the extent of my commentary on the whole thing.
Well, what is your favorite Dylan song? And Bono did not win any Nobel Prize in any category.
What I said to my friend was, for a long time, You're a Big Girl Now was my favorite Bob Dylan song. And then once Mississippi came out, Mississippi is my favorite Bob Dylan song.
Well, Michael, maybe you can help me pronounce this author's name, very well-known author. Jody, is it Picot?
Oh, I don't know, actually.
Well, she is a very, you know, she's a best-selling novelist.
I know her. I just don't know how to say her name.
Okay. She wrote on Twitter, "I'm happy for Bob Dylan. Hashtag, but does this mean I can win a Grammy?" And the answer is, well, Jody, whose last name we can't pronounce, it does mean you can win a Grammy. You can just ask Wynn Cooper. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because way back in 1993-94, he was part of a Sheryl Crow's song, All I Want to Do, which is, was it Fun? I don't know. But he wrote a poem called Fun that was turned into a song by Sheryl Crow and nominated for a Grammy. And thus, he was nominated for the Grammy
Well, that's not the point. She's just saying, I write novels. I'm not going to win a Grammy. Dylan writes rock albums. He shouldn't win the Nobel Prize for Literature. I disagree with her, but that's what she's saying. She's saying he shouldn't win the Michelin Guide 3-star awards. And he shouldn't win a Nobel Prize for Literature because that's not what he does.
And rap music should not be allowed in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Which brings us up to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, and I don't agree with that statement, but that's just another one of those things.
Well, indeed, 19 acts are now nominated. Now, are they on a short list or are they actually nominated, Michael?
Well, they're on the short list and the ballots go out to everybody. There's about 800 people, rock artists, producers, engineers, historians, I think a journalist or two, and then they all vote.
Okay, so they're nominated and now, you know, a whole bunch will be picked. New on the list is, and I guess, why don't we do this, yes or no, Michael and Sal, Joan Baez.
She may be a little bit borderline, but I do think she does deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a big figure in popularizing certain artists, a big figure in folk music, a really good body of work. So I say yes.
And I agree with Michael on all he said.
Well, and if you really want to see how Bob Dylan writes his music, or at least did in the 1960s, watch a little film called Don't Look Back. And you will see Joan Baez is in that film, along with Bob Dylan sitting at a typewriter, and he's writing a song on the typewriter. No music, no guitar. So is he a writer? Well, I guess that moment in time, he was a writer.
I prefer The Other Side of the Mirror, which is a film that depicts Bob Dylan visiting Newport Folk Festival 3 years in a row. And right. It's an absolutely stunning film. I think it's really great, showing him as first the folk hero in the first year, the great new white hope for folk music, and then in a transition period, and then electrified and turning his back on the straitjacket of folk music and needing to do more. It's an absolutely brilliant look at an artist evolving and growing and moving beyond the audience that is holding him up and now holding him back.
May I suggest Band of the Hand with Fiona as a fantastic film. All right, I'm sorry.
Bad Brains. And what I mean by that is the band Bad Brains was a new nominee. So, Michael, yes or no?
People say, what music do you like? And I always say all types of music, except, of course, for like speed metal and hardcore punk. I'm just not really into that fringe industrial stuff. And so I know virtually nothing about Bad Brains. But looking them up, I feel like, yeah, they're representative of this genre, but to me, I don't know if they're important enough. I don't know enough, I think, but my instinct is no.
So?
I absolutely love the Bad Brains. I think they are probably the only band of their kind that were able to combine speed, hardcore, reggae, funk, hard rock. That being said, I don't know if I could get completely behind a yes on that. I think that they've got to have a little bit more. They've influenced a ton of people as well, and I know that's important, mm-hmm. but there's just something, missing. And I love this band, and I could recommend many records, but I think they're missing something, and I'm going to have to say no.
What album should we start with?
Well, the my favorite is Eye Against Eye, because it gives the listener, a first time listener, a little of everything. But I guess their self-titled is the one, you know, is the one. But that may be harder for an initiation. So either of those two are essential to me.
What about Depeche Mode, Michael?
Okay, well, I'm gay, so I guess I should support them, even though they're not gay. They seem very gay-friendly. a band I've never really embraced a lot. Again, I've listened to albums of theirs. I respect them, but I don't feel a lot of passion about them, and I don't think they're again on the edge as far as, well, I know they're somewhat significant, but to me, I don't think they go over the edge enough, so I'm not going to vote for them.
I agree with Michael. I think I like them a little bit more than Michael. I saw them play on the Violator tour 3 times. Just circumstances. And one of those times was at Giants Stadium. And I have never, not for a football game, not for anything, have I seen so many people. It was filled to capacity. The ground was wall to wall people. It shook the entire, the city in Jersey. And it was pretty impressive. And they've got an amazing following. I just don't know if they've done enough to influence. I don't know if they have enough amazing records. And I'm with Michael on this one.
What about Electric Light Orchestra? I'm going to go with a no on that one based on your laughing.
Yeah, it's like, to me, with Jeff Lynne's production, they've always just sounded like they're aping the Beatles, which is something everybody should do. But I never felt like they burst beyond that influence. And I know I'm up for trouble here, but I'm saying no.
I couldn't agree less. Jeff Lynne is so much more than what he appears to be now. It's not just getting on a Beatles bandwagon. This is a guy that was doing, this sort of dance hall, British pop and a bit of psychedelia with the Birthday Party. With the Idol Race. Their album was called The Birthday Party. What he brought to the Move, even though it was for only 2 records, was this sort of harder, rock and blues to Roy Wood's already crazy British pop. I think the ELO records.
And that's what we're talking about. It's the body of work of this particular band.
I'm just getting to the point where once you get to the ELO records, it's not just, well, I write John Lennon type chords. There's so much more influence from before that. And the amount of hits that they had, I just saw him recently, at Radio City, and you forget just how many hits this guy has had and how many people, ELO has influenced. And I don't know. Maybe as I'm saying this out loud now, maybe I'm fighting more for Jeff Lynne, the individual, as opposed to ELO as the band. But I don't know. I think that there's something else.
What album do we start with, or is it their greatest hits?
No, never start with the greatest hits with anyone.
Including Dylan, right? That's what I told people. Pick an album.
No greatest hits, because most of the time the greatest hits are not the best songs. If I had to pick one ELO record, I think most people would say El Dorado, which is great, but I'm going to go with On the Third Day, which is their third record, because it's a little more stripped down. It's not overproduced like the later stuff, but it has the elements of an orchestra, of Stones riffs, Beatle riffs, and something completely unique. And there's a lot of great songs on it.
Now, what about Jane's Addiction? They were
absolutely not. Overrated at the time. I did like Ritual de lo Habitual, however you say that album. I enjoy Lollapalooza. I don't hold them any animosity, but they're just not that important a group at all.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's absolutely no.
What about Journey?
Again, no. One of the best voices in rock from Steve Perry. Some really cool singles. I don't despise them as corporate rock. I don't look down on them. I don't really just particularly like a lot of their music. They've got some cool singles. I'd go see him live sometime, and that's nice, but they're not a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame group.
No, that's a big no. And again, same thing that Michael said. I don't necessarily, before The Sopranos and before Glee, I didn't mind Don't Stop Believing and the singles, they're fine. They're okay singles. It's exactly what they're good at. Some hit singles, but beyond that, it's just, there's nothing. They've influenced no one. I don't believe they've influenced anyone, and I believe that they just came from you know, let's do whatever we can to get a hit and slap it on, you know, 100 times over.
Bingo. I wish I had his voice, though.
Yeah, you know, I know people love his voice. I'm not a fan of his voice either. You know, I don't, they're okay, you know, but no, N-O.
Here is a band that I particularly like. First time nominees, Pearl Jam, yes or no?
I have no special fondness in my heart for Pearl Jam, though whenever I listen to an album of theirs, I go, oh, actually, that's better than I thought. Oh, that's actually quite good. I don't know if they've influenced a lot of people, but I hugely respect their artistic career and the choices that they made to pull back from success and keeping ticket prices low. I think probably as a body of work, I'm sure they'll get in. I think maybe they even deserve to get in. It's not one I'm excited by, but I totally respect it.
Yeah, this is one that I was really on the fence about. I really loved the first couple of records when they came out. I got tired of them very quickly. I hate to say this because it's another can of worms, but I think the weak link is Eddie Vedder. I don't know what people see in his voice. I find his voice grating, with limited range. But I do like Eddie Vedder as a songwriter. I really enjoyed, believe it or not, the ukulele record he did, because you heard a different side of him, and the man is he's got some talent. And some of my favorite songwriters, like Neil Finn, absolutely adores Eddie Vedder. But I don't think Pearl Jam, after their first two or three records, I don't know what they've done aside from sell out arenas that really, you know, stuck to the ribs. So I don't know. I can't give you a real emphatic yes or no on this. But I could give you an emphatic I don't know. How's that?
And they'll be first ballot winners, obviously.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you think so? I don't know about that. Why? I mean, like, doesn't seem like a first ballot winner.
Because I think the rock community likes them more than we do.
Okay.
Well, and I can second the ukulele album by Eddie Vedder is phenomenal. And what that man does with a ukulele is he approaches it like it's a guitar, and it's pretty remarkable, actually. Now, here's one that I think you want to talk about controversial, maybe. Tupac Shakur.
It's not controversial at all. He'll also be a first ballot inductee into the Hall of Fame. I actually don't like what the world has made of Tupac Shakur, because he sort of embraced that gangster mythology, the idea that you have to be tough in order to write about this stuff. In fact, he was taking dance classes. He was a middle-class kid, and I just don't like all the mythology around him, but I'm not even a huge fan of his music, but I think lyrically and influence-wise, there's no question that he'll deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I don't know. I may have to pass on this one. I don't know his work. The rap music that I like is very far removed from the rap music that Tupac had put out. I certainly, based on influence and what they've done for the genre, I had no problem with NWA or Public Enemy, who I happen to be a fan of. So it's not about rap music. It's just about I don't have anything invested in Tupac aside from not really caring for his body of work. So I don't know. If people find that he deserves to get in, I have no problem with it.
Well, I wouldn't vote for him, but he'll get in. Right. And it won't be a scandal that he does.
Well, yeah, because there's already hip-hop artists in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I guess is what makes me call it controversial. And it's really not controversial. I guess it's a classification issue.
There's disco, there's pop, there's country people, there's rock, there's hip-hop. It's all pop music.
But if I said, hey, Yo-Yo Ma is going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you'd say, well, that doesn't fit at all. You know, he's a cellist.
I would. Right. I would, because you don't hear him on the pop radio, but you hear Tupac.
But my question is, could Pearl Jam get in the hip-hop, you know, Hall of Fame?
That's a subgenre.
Okay.
It's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is like pop music. It's the Pop Music Hall of Fame, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Well, maybe they need to change the name. What about, finally, Steppenwolf?
Absolutely not. One song? Yeah. No, thank you.
No. I mean, Born to be Wild and Magic Carpet Ride. That's it. They've basically been a punchline. You know, their records had some decent stuff on it. Monster was a lot of fun. The Pusher was a lot of fun. But yeah, that's not.
Well, those were all first time nominees. What about some of these repeat nominees? I'll list a few. pick two that must get in. Okay, we've got The Cars, Chic, J. Geils Band, Janet Jackson, Chaka Khan, Chaka Khan, Chaka Khan, Let Me Rock You. Or,
yes, yes.
Yeah, okay. Kraftwerk, MC5, Joe Tex, Yes, and The Zombies. What are your two, Michael?
Okay, my two would be J. Geils Band and Chic. I think of all those people, they belong. I would, you know, there's two or three I definitely don't think belong, starting with Janet Jackson. I don't think she remotely has a career that should put her in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Sal, what do you think?
I actually wrote them down as you mentioned them, and I wrote down Chic, absolutely. There was no other band that did what they did, the production work, and absolutely. And I have to say Kraftwerk as well.
Kraftwerk, yeah, that was my third choice.
Very, very, they've been around a long time. They've influenced so many, including David Bowie and
Depeche Mode.
there's so many. It's hard to, you know, there's that the genre of electronic, and then there's the krautrock, and then there's punk, and, you know, Gang of Four. They're just the forefathers of that, and they still play, and I would love to see them get in.
And is there anybody on that list you think should absolutely not be in? There's a couple. Most of them I don't think belong on the repeat nominees. I think most of them haven't made the cut and probably shouldn't.
Yeah, well, Janet Jackson, you know, she dances. That's about it. You know, so I would say no to Janet Jackson. You know, Chaka Khan, I think she's an overrated singer. I think that Rufus was a lot about the band. You know, she does a lot of, you know, she was doing Mariah Carey long before Mariah Carey. It's just a lot of squealing and, you know, the melisma action. And I don't know why she's on that list.
Zombies have one great album. I know that's a great album, but I think that album should be recognized. But I don't think as a band they have enough work.
Who, Rufus?
No, the Zombies.
Oh, the Zombies.
I know you love, you know, the Zombie Odyssey and Oracle. Of course you do.
Well, of course I do. It's one of my top three records of all time. But they also had a whole lot of hits. They were doing British R&B and orchestral pop before anyone else was doing it. Yeah, I mean, you're right. They have, you know, two albums and a record that was pretty much released after they broke up and didn't quite get the acclaim until 30 years later. So, yeah, I could see how do you get into a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with just a tiny body of work? But it's such an important body of work that, again, you'd be hard pressed to find someone that doesn't love this band or that record. So I don't know. It's hard. It's a hard, it's a difficult balance there. I'm a huge fan, and I'm a huge fan of the records, so I have no problem seeing them get in. I would love to see them get in.
Well, fans get one vote, meaning everybody gets to vote. They've got a list of all the nominees, and you can pick your top five, and the top five vote-getters will then make up one ballot. So about 800 ballots, and if all of us vote, you'll get to have one more, you know, point towards the artist that you love. So we got a link in our show notes. I focused on the acts that hadn't made it in yet that I thought were deserving. So my ballot actually has Joan Baez, Chic, J. Geils Band, Kraftwerk, and in a nod to progressive rock, even though I don't love them, Yes.
No, just kidding.
Want me to give five? I couldn't. I, off the top of my head, I don't know if I could come up with the five. I would love to see Kraftwerk. I would love to see the Zombies. I would love to see Procol Harum, but I guess they don't count anymore. Can I write in Todd Rundgren?
absolutely.
You know, and it's. I think the whole thing every year is the same. I can't believe this one didn't get in. I can't believe that one's getting in. Rap music sucks. You know, it's the same thing every year. After all is said and done, then what? You know, who's, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting discussion every year, but I don't think it matters either way.
Well, we can end where we began with Bob Dylan. How well do you know Bob Dylan lyrics? You know, reading this, and you'll see the question of, is it poetry? Is it literature? Is it not? Listen to this. These are Bob Dylan lyrics, and you guys can guess the name of the song. In the courtroom of honor, the judge pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level, and that the strings in the books ain't pulled and persuaded, and that even the nobles get properly handled, once that the cops have chased after and caught him, and that the ladder of law has no top and no bottom, stared at the person who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning. And he spoke through his cloak, most deep and distinguished, and handed out strongly, for penalty and repentance, William Zanzinger with a 6-month sentence. Those are song lyrics, but to what song?
Send in the Clowns.
No idea.
The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll.
You know what? I was going to say The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll because that's just what I always say. So I should have gone with it. That's all right.
Do you really always say that?
Whenever we're talking about new music, and I always say the songs aren't there, or when I defend the Pet Shop Boys because I think they write incredible pop tunes. I always say, not everything has to be Hattie Carroll. Not every song needs to be as deep as The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll to be considered amazing. And so, yes, Hattie Carroll is always a go-to for me one way or the other.
It is by far one of my favorite Bob Dylan songs, and yet it's not very well known. And you read that, that's like the fourth verse, and it could stand on its own without the music.
The new Pep Shop Boys album is really good. I think it'll be on my best of the year list. And people can go to Burnwood tonight and see what music and ideas are on Sal's mind. A few months ago, you did a showdown between two Rolling Stone albums, and you had fans vote track by track on which song they liked better, which was kind of cool. I thought it got a lot of good response. Are you going to do that again, Sal? Or what else can they look for on Burnwood tonight?
Well, yesterday I posted the entire Fleetwood Mac Then Play On record.
Great album.
And it's this record never fails to astound me for so many reasons, because what is it? I mean, is it a blues record? Is it a psychedelic record? It can be both. There's parts of it that sound like a surf record. You know, there's parts of it that sound like a new age record. I can't think of a record that's as unique as that and still has the two guys that you know, we're behind Rumors. So what I think I want to do more often is, because I'm really never behind any new thing enough to get excited to write about it, I want to continue doing what I'm doing, which is to highlight some records that people just may not know. I mean, you know, there are people who think that Fleetwood Mac's first record is the you know, the Fleetwood Mac record with Monday Morning and Rihanna.
They have
no
clue.
There was 10 records beforehand, and of those 10, 7 of them are pretty amazing.
Well, Sal Nunziata, we will place a link to your work and your blog, Burnwood Tonight, in the show notes. Thank you very much for taking the time to, go through all of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees from this year and also discuss Bob Dylan.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Yeah, so it was good of Sal to stop by. I know that when the announcement was made, I was kind of really surprised how thrilled I was. I thought it was very, very cool, very well-deserving. And a lot of people said, what album should I listen to? And if you follow us on Facebook or follow me on Facebook, you'll know I said, hey, do not listen to greatest hits. Don't say, Alexa, play Bob Dylan.
Great. Now there's like 1,000 Bob Dylans. Listen, 1,000 Alexas out there playing Bob Dylan.
One can only hope. I said, check out an album, listen to an entire album while you're driving, while you're jogging, while you're doing something, whatever you do when you listen to music, or just sit down and pay attention. But listen to Blood on the Tracks, his quiet masterpiece, Highway 61 Revisited, which is his full-on electric album, or Bringing It All Back Home, which is sort of the bridge between the electric period and his rock and roll period. Any of those, there's a million great Bob Dylan albums, but those three are three really good places to start.
Okay, you're picking albums for Bob Dylan albums, in fact, for people to listen to. But every week over on Book Filter, a book lover's best friend, you pick the big book of the week. So what is it going to be this week?
Oh, that's right. This week, I'm always looking at books and thinking what makes good properties for TV or film. And there's a couple of really fun books. There's a book called Cracking the Cube, which is about the world of competitive Rubik's Cube solving. And I have a friend's son who does that. And also about the author trying to track down the guy who created the Rubik's Cube, but doesn't ever give interviews. And there's Fun Science, which is the sort of a vlogger named Charlie McDonnell who loves science and talks about science. He's sort of like a younger, sexier Bill Nye. And then there's this history book, which I really love, called The Tunnels. And it's the true life story of people who were trying to escape East Germany when the wall was up, the Berlin Wall. And instead of going over the top, they were trying to dig tunnels underground to escape to West Germany. And what's really fascinating about this is that some of them got funded in part to do it by American networks, who were paying them to do it in exchange for exclusive rights to the footage and their story, which that is mind-blowing to me. They were saying, here's $50,000 so you can build a tunnel to escape East Germany, but we want your story. I think that's just bizarre. But my pick of the week is a mystery. It's called IQ. It's by Joey Day, and it's set in contemporary Los Angeles, sort of in the hip-hop world. You've got this young kid who's a Japanese American. He's an orphan and he solves crimes, sort of an amateur detective in the sense that he doesn't have a license and he doesn't work for the cops. He's just a guy that people come to, much like Easy Rollins in the Walter Mosley books, and they say, I've got a problem, and he helps them solve it. It's really smart. It's really good. It's a great character. And you go back in time from the contemporary world where he's helping this rapper who thinks somebody's trying to kill him, and you go back to when he was a kid and his brother died, and he was falling into a life of crime. So it's sort of like the story of how he became who he is and solving a crime today. Really smart, really fun book. I really loved it a lot.
Well, I wonder if Elton John right now is thinking, well, apparently to win a Nobel Prize for literature, I don't need to write a book. So maybe that's what, you know, I won't write my autobiography, which is what he is going to do. I guess he sat on the roof and kicked off the moss, and he said, yeah, I'll write my autobiography.
No, that makes no sense. Dylan did publish this by a memoir called Chronicles, and in fact, it was received universally
as
a masterpiece. And in fact, I think it's a key reason why he did win the Nobel Prize for Literature. He had one novel called Tarantula, which is dreadful, from the 60s. And then he had this memoir, which is an absolutely great book. And so I think that really, really helped him win the Nobel Prize for Literature. The fact that he had a memoir and it was published and it really was a masterpiece. So no, if Elton John wants to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, writing a memoir is the way to go. He's got a crazy life. If he's willing to be honest and straightforward, it could be a lot of fun. I'd certainly be interested in reading it. I don't know about Bob Iger, though.
Well, Bob Iger, I think it's going to be more of a here's how to manage. You know, Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, he's going to write a book on business leadership for Random House, which will be published, I guess, sometime next year. And, you know, it's untitled and will draw from, you know, all the lessons he's learned as the CEO of Disney. And that could be interesting, but more as a case study, if you will.
Well, that's exactly, it's just a how-to book, a management book, a guide to success. But I don't have a list of names to trot out, but my feeling is once you're a big, popular, well-known CEO, and then you decide to publish a book like this, that's when your career is on the downslide. I just think it's not a good sign to be writing one of these books.
Well, he actually is on his way out, and he does not want to be picked up again by Disney. He is. He said he's done. I think 2018 is his last year. So,
well, he keeps trying to quit.
Yes,
but
he
hasn't done it yet.
No, but when he does, I think for Disney, it will be newsworthy.
That's right. It'll be a big deal.
Oh, thank you for taking the bait, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, it's literally late breaking news. I can't believe you got this in the show notes, Michael. Lots of Hollywood lawsuits would become major cases if they ever made it to trial, but that's especially true for one just filed over the classic mockumentary. I did not say documentary. I said mockumentary. This is Spinal Tap. Harry Shearer put in motion a $125 million lawsuit over the film and accuses companies of all sorts of accounting hijinks over the years. As a result, Shearer says he and other creatives have received a total of, get this, $81 in merchandising. That's how much they've received. And $98 in music sales over the years. Their contract gives them 40% of net earnings in those categories, among other rights. Shearer's lawyers began looking into the income when the 1984 film turned 30. And the really fun twist is a legal issue popping up more and more in music, but just starting to come into play in movies. After 35 years, it's possible for authors to terminate grants and regain rights, which means Shearer and all the others who took place, you know, who participated in This Is Spinal Tap, they could own the film as soon as 2019? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a very big deal if it gets to trial. I'm confused as to why it's just Harry alone and not the other creatives like Rob Reiner and Christopher Guest. So that's a bit of a question mark for me. But it's a fascinating case, both the accounting shenanigans and the idea of reclaiming the rights to your movie. So this will be a fun one to watch.
And the funny thing is, Harry Shearer could not be wealthier. I mean, the guy has been on The Simpsons for 25 years, so...
Well, even if you're rich, you really don't like it when people walk into your home and steal your stuff. So I don't think it's a question of how much money are you worth. Because he has money, he's able to afford to file the lawsuit. That's an important thing to keep in mind.
True.
A lot of people who are screwed over can't afford to try and, you know, do what they need to do in order to get their rights. They can't hire an accountant to look at the books. He can, he has, and he should.
Well, and Chris Rock said, look, I don't care about, you know, getting my money off of some royalty. Pay me now. Okay, because with Kevin Hart enjoying massive success with his new concert film, we talked about that earlier, comedian Chris Rock has decided to show the upstart exactly how it's done. For starters, Rock is taping not one, but two comedy specials for Netflix, and he's getting, get this, $40 million for the effort. He'll
wow.
film the specials after touring the country with his new act, though how he'll keep all the material from leaking online without locking up everyone's phone is beyond us. Netflix can afford the cost. Their stock soared 20% when the company announced it had signed up almost 1 million more customers worldwide than originally forecast in the most recent quarter. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Guy gets, you know, deal to make a comedy film. The ghost of Karen Woodward is back. You know, guy gets job, but it's a lot of money. It's notable. It's a return to stand up for Chris Rock, who hasn't done it in, I think, like 8 years or something. But I was most intrigued by how Netflix soared with their stock. You know, people, Netflix, they've reached peak. Oh, wow. They're still signing up a lot of people around the world. And there's a lot of room to grow as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we didn't say about Netflix last week when we were talking about how Reed Hastings said, the movie theater owners are killing the movie industry. We talked about that. But he also said something else. He said, yeah, we're not interested in China because... You know, look at what happened to Apple and Amazon and all those people who went in there and tried to create, you know, movie services. They got shut down. So we're going to take the rest of the world. China, you know, it's a big question mark for everybody. We're out.
They said they don't want to invest the money in China until they know that they're going to have a stable business environment where they're going to feel like their investment isn't wasted.
Right.
I don't think that they said we don't care about China. They're just like, now is not the time. You know, we want to make sure we can, if we invest, that we're going to get a return on our investment. We want to have a level playing field for businesses. And I think that's more important as a salvo to China than it is, you know, it shows the power of them to say, yeah, we don't need you yet. China, you know, they want businesses working there, so they need to rethink how they do their work.
I agree. Now, you hear the name IMAX, and you think big screens, or in Michael's case, you know, kind of big screens, not really. Some of them are big, some of them aren't. In the future, they hope you hear the name IMAX and think virtual reality. That's realistically not going to happen. Actually, forget about the future, because IMAX already has plans to open a virtual reality site in Los Angeles in a few weeks. That will be followed by IMAX virtual reality sites in China, Japan, the Middle East, and Western Europe, including a site in Manchester, England. They'll offer entertainment and games with the initial pricing of only about $12. That's cheaper than their movies, but then the VR experience will only last, you know, less than 15 minutes. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Okay.
Is there a need for dedicated sites to do virtual reality? Is that really important? Do you need to, I mean, maybe tomorrow, but like within 5 years with everybody having VR goggles in their homes, is there a space there that's needed for that? Or is that just a temporary game, a temporary play?
I think it's a temporary play for now, unless what they can do is so much better than what you can get at home. Which it very well might be, because what you can get at home right now is limited by the computers that...
No, I know today. But I'm just saying, you know, in a few years, if you've got really good goggles at home, are you going to need to go to an IMAX center?
Maybe not.
Is that what you... Most people don't envision that, do they? They think everybody's going to have goggles and be doing stuff in their home.
Correct.
Okay.
Billy Bush, you're fired. That's what NBC has told the once bland, now controversial member of the morning news show Today. He's been released and is... a free agent ready to work with no non-compete clause holding him back. ABC, CBS, Fox News, anyone? MSNBC? No? Well, I guess MSNBC would be out, right? Because it's NBC. Bush was caught on tape egging on Donald Trump in creepy sexual boasting during an off-the-cuff moment more than a decade ago. The tape became a flashpoint in the U.S. presidential campaign, and Bush was caught in the crossfire. Negotiations got a little tense towards the end when Bush's people pointed out publicly that Bush was an NBC employee doing a puff piece interview promoting a primetime juggernaut, The Apprentice, and a daytime soap to air on the Universal-owned show Access Hollywood. As they claimed, if Bush told Trump to shut the heck up, he might well have been fired the next day. Instead, he was fired a decade later and gets millions of dollars for his trouble. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. And of course, the story becomes not that he was fired for this particular reason, but a host of reasons that have come to the surface since then. He wasn't really well liked on the Today set. He had trouble at the Olympics where he scored a coup by getting an interview with Ryan Lochte. But then when it turned out that Ryan Lochte's story about being,
robbed at gunpoint,
mugged, had sort of question marks by it. Billy Bush, instead of, you know, going with the news flow, tried to defend his work and defend Ryan Lochte and got slapped down for it by Al Roker. Managed an agent, started saying, yeah, you know, I don't really like him. He's not good with women. He was dismissive to us when we were on the red carpet. I don't know if I'd want my guests being booked into his hour. You know, so the NBC said this is not, you know, they already had some question marks about him fitting into the team. And it wasn't a lot of negatives, just made it not worthwhile. So I think this was the tipping point, but there's more to the story that we finally learned about.
Now, with Trump boasting about sexual assault, okay, that was our last story. Fox News head Roger Ailes fired for sexual harassment and Billy Bush out at NBC, as we just mentioned. It seems all the news is bad when it comes to sex and politics. But in a win for politics and sexual orientation, Fox News anchor Shepard Smith has finally come out publicly as a gay man. This amounted to an open secret, with gay publication Out Magazine naming him as an influential gay figure in the past. But it still matters, especially since Smith is the face of the actual news coverage at Fox News, as opposed to the talking heads and opinion shows like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It matters because of who he is and the audience that he has on Fox News, which is the number one news channel. The face of the number one news channel in the country just came out as gay. That's a big deal.
Well, do you think he had to wait for Roger Ailes to not be there to do that?
He says absolutely not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I take him at his word.
Okay. He said it three times. Okay. Well, maybe.
Yes, he said it three times.
Maybe he's trying to get a Nobel Prize for literature.
Keep going.
Okay. Do you feel like your cable bill keeps getting larger and larger and larger and you don't know why?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yes, I most certainly can agree with that. Well, the FCC agrees with you too, Michael. They've just fined Comcast $2.3 million for cramming, quote unquote. That's the practice of billing customers for services they never explicitly ordered or wanted. Which sounds more like scamming than cramming to me. It can usually be found in line items on your bill related to things like premium channels, DVRs, and those pesky little set-top boxes that we've been talking about lately. In addition to the fine, Comcast must implement a 5-year compliance plan to avoid cramming in the future, to which they said, look, you know, they insist they were already making many of the changes demanded in the consent decree. Anyway, and they got all defensive by pointing out there was no admission of wrongdoing on their part. And besides, they study all the time. There's no need for them to cram. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, right?
Well, yeah, especially when it's a $2.3 million fine.
A $2.3 million fine. You've got to be kidding me. And now people have to file a Freedom of Information Act to find out how many examples did they find? What sort of money are we talking about? $2.3 million is a joke, much less a 5-year compliance plan. Please take 5 years to stop ripping off your customers. Really? 5 years to stop ripping off your customers? I mean, this is a pathetic joke, really.
Especially when Comcast has been charged previously with, throttling internet speeds.
Yeah, this is a three strikes, you're out. You know, they're screwing people over left and right. And if you're from Comcast, call us and tell us why we're wrong. How can they do that?
They can call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, Michael Moore just pulled a Beyonce and dropped his new movie on the world.
Oh, snap.
Yes, that's right. It's called Michael Moore in Trumpland, which I didn't realize was an amusement park. It is a documentary of a show he's been working on about this presidential race, and it's playing for free today at New York City's IFC Center. The October surprise then begins a theatrical run on Wednesday, though it's kind of unclear if the movie will just be at IFC, if it's playing wider, and if or when it becomes available online. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but I guess we'll have to wait till after we see the movie. Maybe he's uncovered some stuff that'll make some news. I'm assuming not, but, you know, somehow when you present it all together, it can have an impact, just like you did with Fahrenheit 9/11. So, you know, we'll have to see when the movie is reviewed tonight or tomorrow. I assume he'll make it available on demand or streaming so everyone around the country can see it before Election Day. There'd be no point in doing this otherwise, but we don't have any details yet.
We have to wait until November 18th. And what are you saying we have to wait for? Well, we have to wait to see the new movie Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. That is, of course, set in the wizarding world of Harry Potter, albeit about 90 years ago in 1920s New York. Anticipation is high. And no, we're not talking about fans. We're talking about Warner Brothers. The Harry Potter films were 8 of the most successful movies in film history, and they really hope lightning will strike twice with Fantastic Beasts. You know, actually, make that 3 times if you count the stage play success. If Warner Brothers is nervous, they're not showing it. Author J.K. Rowling confirmed at a fan event that the proposed trilogy of movies has now been bumped up to 5 films in all. Yes, 5, and we haven't even seen the first one yet. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, God, big whoop. At least let us see the movie before you tell us you're expanding the trilogy to 5 movies. That just, it's kind of exhausting before it even begins. You're like, is it any good? You know? Oh, well. I think it's a question of, you know, having so many ideas and not having an editor to question her thoughts and saying, we can do more. You know, just like the final books, I think, in this fantasy world, she seems a little out of control.
The Broadway grosses usually come out on Monday afternoon, just after we finish recording. But this week, we're recording on a Tuesday so we can take a glance at the charts. Hamilton now has a stranglehold on number one thanks to ever-rising ticket prices that put it ahead of The Lion King. Hamilton grossed $2.1 million versus just under $2 million for Disney's blockbuster. Disney can take comfort with Aladdin, though, which is now firmly a major blockbuster looking set to become one of the biggest hits in Broadway history, though just like that company's show Mary Poppins, it's doing so without gaining a lot of attention. Just a few weeks ago, there was only one play on Broadway. Thanks to The Fall, there are plenty more led by Nathan Lane and an all-star cast in a revival of the newspaper comedy The Front Page, which grossed a massive $1.2 million. It's a limited run, which is another way of saying it'll run as long as Nathan Lane wants it to run. Lots of new shows on the charts, including a revival of the musical Falsettos, or should I say Falsettos, which is slowly building an audience thanks to word of mouth. Get it? Word of mouth? Anyway, big deal or big whoop?
I don't get it. Word of mouth?
Word of mouth. Falsetto. Never mind. Vocal.
Okay. It's a big deal. It's The Fall. Not a lot of shows to get excited by, but it's kind of exciting to see the draw of Nathan Lane. He really is like a Broadway legend. You think about Zero Mostel or some other larger-than-life figures that have, you know, trod the boards. He's certainly one of them.
Well, you know, on your recommendation, I know people who have seen The Front Page, and yikes, they said it belonged on the back page.
Oh, dear me. Oh, well.
Okay, well, speaking of Falsettos, the popular segment Elmo's World will be returning to Sesame Street when the 47th season debuts on HBO. A newly revamped Elmo's World will be included after 7 years off the air. Sesame Street always refines and retires the rest segments, only to bring them back later. But Elmo's World was complicated for various reasons. It was seen as skewing too young when the show was looking to grow the median age of its viewers.
It's from like 3 to 4, by the way.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you're only got like 5 years to worry about, that's a pretty big jump. Its initial creator, Judy Freudberg, was ill and ultimately died of a brain tumor when the segment was initially due for a break. And of course, the voice of Elmo was at one point Kevin Clash, a performer caught up in allegations of improper relations with young men. Charges ultimately dropped in civil lawsuits because the statute of limitations had expired. Boy, and all we wanted to do was learn how to count and spell the word cat. Is the return of Elmo's World a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, good God, I almost did you and started to speak in the voice of Elmo. I think it's a big whoop, you know, but it does bring a little new attention to the fact that they're now on HBO.
That's true, but that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're talking about Amazon because they launched their music streaming service just last week.
Or should we say they're relaunching their music streaming service?
Well, no.
I mean, they've had Amazon Prime Music for years. It just was lame. And now they're like, all right, let's do this seriously.
That's right. Now it's a subscription service, not just with 2 million tracks, but now it's got, you know, the same as Spotify and Apple Music. It's called Amazon Music Unlimited. And it costs $9.99 per month for anybody that's not an Amazon Prime subscriber. So if you subscribe to Amazon Prime here in North America or in the other places throughout the world where Amazon Prime is available, then it only costs $7.99. But if you are just subscribing to Amazon Music Unlimited, it's $9.99. And to
so it's $8 to $10 a month.
Yes. Basically,
except,
and here's the thing, we apologize for anybody that has an Amazon Echo, and here's why, because we're about to say Amazon Echo and the word Alexa a lot, okay? Because if you have one of these devices, and it's these, like, artificial intelligence, you can ask, you know, Alexa, what time is it? Alexa, who won the Dodgers game? And, you know, it basically is
it's also a nice big speaker.
Yeah, it's a smart speaker, basically. If you have one of those, you can subscribe to Amazon Music Unlimited for $3.99 a month. However, you can only listen to it on the Amazon Echo.
Right. I hate saying $3.99. It's $4 a month.
Right.
You know, we don't need to do the price point. Right. So it's a little confusing. I thought, wow, if you own the Echo, you can subscribe for $4 a month. That's awesome. But it turns out, if you have an Echo in your kitchen and an Echo in your bedroom, it will only play on one of them, I think. You have to pay for every extra Echo you have.
Are you sure about that?
That's how I understood it when I looked at their website. But it's also like you can't listen to the music on your phone or on your laptop. It's only through that speaker. So that's kind of annoying and stupid. It's not as exciting as I thought it would be. It's like you've bought the speaker. Do you want to pay $50 a year to have music come out of it? Well, maybe you do, because I know a lot of people who try to use their Amazon Echo for Spotify and other services, and it doesn't always work great. You have to do sort of a workaround, don't you?
Well, basically, you have to play it through a device like a laptop or a phone that then streams through the Amazon Echo. But the reality is, I mean, Amazon Echo, it's an okay speaker. It's you know, kind of a medium to good speaker. It's not, you know, a transistor radio, so it's better than that. But it's okay, and it certainly can be very loud, that's for sure. It's more of a really good, you know, like if it's in the kitchen, you could say, you know, Alexa, how many cups in a quart? And it'll tell you, or, you know, give me my, wake me up tomorrow at 6 a.m. It'll do all of those things. It's actually, okay, I'm sure that could not be picked up right now on this mic that I'm talking into. However, outside the studio, I have an Amazon Echo. And guess what it just said?
I've set alarm for 9 a.m.
Yes, alarm set for 6 a.m. tomorrow. So it can do all. Now I have to figure out how to turn the thing off. So otherwise, I'm up at 6 a.m.
Well, you say it's not that good a speaker, and that's true. But the fact is, they were looking and seeing that people were using Alexa to play music. They were playing music. They play music through their Echo. My friends do it in their house. People do it a lot because it's open and it's easy. You don't have to turn on your computer. You don't have to turn up the stereo. It's always on. You just say, Alexa, do this, do that. And so it's a convenient way. It's not the best speaker in the world. I think now they're going to say, hey, we need to have some deluxe Echoes where you can get an even better stereo system going. I think that'll be the next step that they do. But the fact is, Echo is hugely popular. The fact is that it is all over and people are using it to play music. Now they can upgrade slightly. But more importantly, Amazon now has a real streaming service that competes with the big boys.
Yes. The question is it too little too late?
Well, it wasn't too late for Apple, was it?
No, but then think about the difference there, okay?
Apple, well, they both got a huge customer base.
Right, but Apple had iTunes, was already one of the world's largest music sellers, which I will say Amazon is as well. However, Apple was the largest digital music seller. Okay. And so I guess what I'm saying is they have all these devices called iPhones where Apple Music just kind of fit in. The only place.
Yeah,
where
but Amazon is a big music seller too. They've got a huge customer base. If you're already paying for your Amazon Prime, you can get the service for $8 a month, which is cheaper than anybody else. And that's ad free.
Well, I'm just going to keep Spotify.
Well, I don't blame you. You've already got one and you're happy with it.
Yeah.
But I think this is a real player. I think there's a lot of room to grow, and Amazon will prove that just like Apple did last year.
Well, I guess we can go back in time on a future show and see whether you're right. The reason I mentioned Spotify is because they've paid $1.2 billion this year to the music industry already, which I would say would be great if they hadn't already lost $10 billion. And by they, I mean the music industry since 1999 is like off by like 70% or some ridiculous amount. So paying $1 billion into what used to be a $20 billion industry, nice, but it needs to be more.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they're trying to pay less, so go figure. But that wraps up our show this week. Again, I'd like to thank Sal Nunziato for joining us. Now, you can subscribe
at the last minute, dude. That was nice of him.
Yes, indeed. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, speaking of iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Any podcast aggregator is where you can find us. Again, it does help us out when you subscribe to the show, rate, and review the show on any one of those podcast aggregators.
And you haven't done it yet, have you? Well, get your assist. Alexa, rate Showbiz Sandbox 5 stars. Alexa, write a comment saying Showbiz Sandbox is awesome.
Alexa, make that a 5-star comment. I'm waiting for Alexa to say, well, I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode and links to Sal Nunziato's work can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our page can be found if you search for the words Showbiz Sandbox. Go figure. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, who have not been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but they can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's obvious, but the website is Alexa, send Michael money.com.
If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you can always check out Book Filter. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.